I want to read one verse tonight in relation to the subject that we're dealing with, Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. And what I wanted to begin with is a discussion on internet use, the use and management of internet-connected devices, because this is a subject that we've had to deal with recently as our children become, I don't know, just to that stage where they're having to use devices more. And you maybe have a few incidents where you wonder, you realize that you aren't in control of everything. Like, there's things that pop up that surprise you and you don't realize that. If you're naive about it, you can get caught out. So I wanted to deal with this, and I'll go through what's before us here on this page, and then if you have questions, I'll be happy to discuss them. But the first point is why screen time needs to be regulated. Why screen time needs to be regulated. So there are two main reasons. First, the developmental damage, and then secondly, the compulsive habits. Now, the developmental damage is known by everyone. If you read about this and screen time and children spending time in front of screens, you can see here that too much screen time may lead to several problems, including but not limited to lower grades, problems with sleep, weight, mood. Other research has shown negative effects on memory, attention, and language skills. Too much screen time negatively impacts communication skills, problem solving, and if you read widely enough, you'll find that there are a whole host of things that are addressed in this. The guideline for use by the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry is 0 to 18 months, limited to being with a family or family member, and video chatting via FaceTime or similar. Basically, no independent use. The only time 0 to 18 months they say that they should ever be in front of a screen is if you're talking to your grandparents or whatever via screen. They shouldn't sort of just dump them in front of a screen and let it kind of babysit them or something. They shouldn't be in front of a screen unless it's for this reason. So this is secular. And then when they get to 18 months to 24 months, limited to watching educational programming with a caregiver. So mom is sitting there and they envisage with parental guidance, they're watching something. But there's always a parent or some older person that's there. And then 2 to 5 years old, non-educational screen time limited to about 1 hour per weekday and 3 hours on the weekends. So this is their recommendations. This is what they say. Again, at that point, when you get to 4, 5, 3, 4, 5, there may be some educational reasons to be using the screen, but only 1 hour per weekday and 3 hours on a Saturday or Sunday. 6 years plus, encourage healthy habits and limit activities that include screens. So it's just more broad. So this is their advice. I'm not giving any, not saying this is my advice, this is their counsel. The second reason why you need to regulate it is because of compulsive habits. Researchers deny categorizing screens similar to addictive drugs, so they don't see them the same. Addiction-like behavior is not the same as something like nicotine or other drugs, but that's not to say there are not concerning patterns. So there are patterns of addictive behavior, and there's debate about what's going on in a young mind as they engage with the screen, as they, and obviously the recognition of developmental hindrance in all of this, the danger that they would be drawn into a habitual use of the screen when it has this negative impact is the concern. So good habits then that I've put down here in relation to this. So you maintain the 1 hour free limit kind of per day, Monday to Friday. So this is what they recommend. So it's when children are young, they're going to want to use it. Now, you may eliminate it entirely. I don't think that's going to be realistic in most homes. So the question is, well, how long? And this is the policy we use, basically. We have 1 hour Monday to Friday, if that. But that's they are allowed from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock on screen. And so all their work has to be done by then. Everything they need to do has to be done by then. And then they have an hour of watching stuff and playing around and different games that they're allowed to play for an hour, that's it. Obviously, screens off during family meals, and then avoid using screens as pacifiers, babysitters, stopping tantrums. And then I've added in here as well that whatever you decide to do on a Saturday, in terms of perhaps being a little bit more relaxed, on the Lord's Day, just zero. Just eliminate it. Make it a different day. That's what we do. That's my encouragement to you, that as you deal with the complexities of teaching them, even teaching them how to give a day over to God, one of the ways is, okay, so on the Lord's Day, just not have it. Now, there may be argument for watching certain edifying things, possibly, but even there, can you get them to read a book instead? Can you get them to do some kind of games or like Christian-related games, quizzes based on Bible trivia, whatever, instead of doing this? I think you'll find it far more rewarding. So these are the reasons why you need to regulate it. Like, if you don't regulate it, if you don't try to regulate time in front of the screen, you're going to have damage to them in their development overall, and you're going to create compulsive habits where they become dependent on the use of screens. And I remember the first time we discovered it ourselves, when we didn't have a TV, so we didn't have them interact with the screen a lot. And then we went on vacation and went to a hotel, and in that hotel there was a television. So we went out for the day, went for a walk, did whatever we were doing, came back, and there was kind of this unlimited time in front of the television later that day. And so the kids were watching and watching and watching, and then I don't know if it was dinner time or what it was, or we're going to do Bible time or something, and called them away, and they were so grumpy. They were completely out of character. It was so marked that, what's wrong with you? This is not my child. And we realized that them sitting there in front of that screen had some negative impact on them. And you couldn't miss the correlation. It was so clear to be seen. So we realized that you can't. When we eventually did have them engaging with screens more, we realized you have to have a limit on this, otherwise. And sometimes you get caught out. Sometimes on a Saturday, you're more relaxed. Then you call them for lunch, and there's a temper tantrum, or there's some other exhibition that isn't normal to them. And you realize, again, that you just can't have unlimited use of these screens. So I'm raising awareness, if you're not aware of this yet, to realize that you need to regulate this. I don't think you can eliminate it. That will be up to you to decide. But if you're going to have children engage with TVs, iPads, computers, there needs to be regulation of it. Secondly, why training on internet use has limitations. So we may have a mentality where I'm going to train the children in their use of devices and the internet. And I had a conversation with a young man on one occasion. It was very enlightening to me. He was, in the course of the conversation, he revealed that he was concerned about his ability to serve God because, in his opinion, if he was a real man of God, he wouldn't have to have measures that would protect him in his use of the internet. So he had a measure in place that hindered him from seeing material that would be unbecoming for a Christian to see. And he thought then that he was less of a man of God because he needed that, which I'd never encountered that, but that was his opinion. And he was concerned that he was not of himself able to resist, and he had to have these measures in place. And I told him, as I put here, if you own a dog, there are two ways to keep that dog on your property. You either train it in terms of, here's the boundaries of the property, and you're able to train that dog so it doesn't go beyond that boundary, or you fence it in. Those are two options, and they're both legitimate. There's nothing wrong with one or the other. But if you don't fence it in, and I didn't put this in because it's a little, I don't know, you have to be careful. But let me just say it. We're here among friends. If a dog is in heat, it doesn't matter what kind of fences you have. They're going to find a way. If you've ever had a dog that's in heat, that dog will do everything to get out of there, and other dogs will do anything to get in. So even what you train it becomes different when something triggers in the mind, and there's a certain kind of condition in which they find themselves. So a couple of reasons, again, why it's important that we don't simply train our children on how to use the internet, that we don't just say, here are bad pictures and you shouldn't look at them, or here are things to look out for, or if you're uncomfortable with something you see, then you turn away, you go to mommy and daddy. It's not enough just to train them in that way. First, pornography is pervasive. There are some areas in life where we can afford to be naive. Internet pornography is not one of them. Now, there are many problems in society that we can agree on. Think problems that we look at and we say, like, everyone says this is a problem. So we look at it and everyone agrees this is an issue. 90-something% of people would say this is a problem. But pornography is not one. Of those that are 13 to 24 years of age, there is a belief that not recycling is worse than viewing pornography. So that's conditioning over the upcoming generation. So in their mentality, if you watch pornography, you're more upstanding than if you don't recycle. And that comes through conditioning. That comes through what the media is telling them, what they see in terms of government programs. Recycle, 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 and they have it. And I'm not against recycling, so I'm not saying. I'm just giving you perspective that the world they grow up in is not condemning pornography in a way that they inherently are being taught this is wrong. So they're growing up and thinking, you're a bad person, you don't recycle. But you watch pornography and it's not as big a deal. And that shows then the difference between the campaigning that has been going on over recent years. 51% of male students and 32% of female students first viewed porn before their teenage years. So before they're even teens, half of boys are seeing this. The first exposure to pornography among men is 12 years old on average. 71% of teens hide online behavior from their parents. And you might imagine, surely the church is different. That life in the church is vastly distinct from the rest of the world. Well, according to a study, 64% of Christian men and 15% of Christian women say they watch porn at least once a month. These are the people that acknowledge it when they're asked. So, it took as long for Adam and Eve to fall into sin as it did for man to take internet technology and use it as a medium for sin. Didn't take long at all. And as video technologies developed and online streaming increased, so did the access to sin. It's actually been, for those of us who of a certain age who have watched the development of the internet. So I got my first computer when I was 15. This was 1998, thereabouts. And I have seen the change. So in terms of what was available then, most of the stuff, access to stuff, for the most part, required a credit card. Everything was behind a paywall. And there were people making money off of pornography, but you had to pay. So if you're a child, then you don't have a credit card unless you're stealing it from parents. And even as an adult, you're aware that this is like a digital trace on you. So it would almost be a hindrance. You have to get the credit card out. You have to acknowledge it. There's a danger of the bill coming in being read by a spouse and you're trying to do it secretly. So all of this created more of a barrier to these things. But with YouTube and the rising technology and video and internet speeds and video technology, the fact that people have videos on their phone. So what, the iPhone came out in 2007, YouTube 2005, I think was bought by Google around 2007, I'm going by memory. So thereabouts, so you have the rise of YouTube with the rise of the iPhone, and behind the scenes you have YouTube-like platforms that are dedicated to pornography, that are freely accessible, as easily as you can go on to YouTube and view things and look things up. So these platforms are developing behind the scenes so that people can access it without taking out the credit card, without any hindrance or barrier whatsoever. In addition, you don't have to go seeking for it. Advertisements on websites, videos, apps, and games often include inappropriate content. you could download an app for your child that's like a puzzle. It's just a brain teaser type thing, or they have to burst the bubbles, or some kind of thing that you download for free, and you think it's completely innocent. And then every so often, when they get to the next level or something, an ad comes up that you're not in control of, and they're not in control of. And sometimes those advertisements contain stuff that you would be appalled if you're aware of what they're seeing. If you have ever used Spotify for free, I don't have a subscription to Spotify, but I've downloaded the app, I've listened to the free version, so they pepper it with advertisement. And we have had occasions where we're listening, so we have it streaming through the speakers in the house, and an advertisement comes on. It's like, get that off. I mean, it's the middle of the day, it's meant to be family friendly, but my sensibilities, how I view what my children should be hearing versus what the world thinks my children should be hearing are vastly distinct. Our worldviews are worlds apart. So you have to be really aware of the fact these things exist and are going on. So as we say, pornography is pervasive. That's why training has its limitations, because you can train your children, but this is everywhere. And they're not in control. It's not about, my child would never look for this. It doesn't matter. They don't have to look for it. It will find them. It will come to them sooner or later. B, training isn't sufficient. So we establish this a little more. With the onset of puberty, teaching your children and teenagers what is right and wrong and when to turn away from improper images will not suffice when they reach a certain age. In his book, I have it here, haven't read it, probably read it about 12 years ago, Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. It's a fascinating book, by the way, if you just like from a human psychology perspective, just how people respond. Has some very interesting chapters in it. But one of them, the sixth chapter, he deals with arousal and the effect that has on the brain. And I put here part of what he reveals. So he refers to an experiment he was involved with in 2001, in which they invited students to help them understand the degree to which attitudes change when people are in an impassioned state. While they could have tested something like anger, and that was part of the thought, should we test anger? How people determine what they would do in a cold state versus what they do when they're actually angry and upset. And he goes on actually to deal with this in the chapter, such as advising people not to drive when they're angry, because it changes parts of the brain and everything as well. It makes them more aggressive drivers. And so it deals with part of that. But what was fascinating to me was this particular angle of the study that they came at, what they decided to do. So they could have tested anger, but they tested sexual arousal. I'll spare you the details, and I just a disclaimer, that chapter isn't particularly pleasant to read. But basically they questioned them in a cold state, determining what was morally right, the preferences, their determination to practice what the world calls safe sex, and so on and so forth. All these questions that they're asked. And then on another occasion, some months later, they brought them back and they questioned them in an aroused state. And here are the findings. This is it in a nutshell, sparing you some of the gory details. The results show that when Roy, that's one of the people they specify in the study, that when Roy and the other participants were in a cold, rational, superego-driven state, they respected women. They were not particularly attracted to the odd sexual activities we asked them about. They always took the moral high ground, and they expected that they would always use a condom. They thought that they understood themselves, their preferences, and what actions they were capable of. But as it turned out, they completely underestimated their reactions. No matter how we looked at the numbers, it was clear that the magnitude of underprediction by the participants was substantial. Across the board, they revealed in their unaroused state that they themselves did not know what they were like once aroused. Prevention, protection, conservatism, and morality disappeared completely from the radar screen. They were simply unable to predict the degree to which spaghetti gets wet and hot passion would change them. They don't know themselves. They simply aren't aware. They have their stated kind of, this is what I would do. But whenever they're in an impassioned state, all of that goes out the window. This is why I believe, this when I'm reading this as a Christian, I'm reading it and going, this is why they had chaperones. They understood this. They knew that, okay, these are two God-fearing individuals. They love the Lord. But there comes a point when biology will overtake and there are limits to their will. Biology diminishes the power of the will. Lack of sleep, this is another issue, but you'll find lack of sleep also diminishes judgment, which is why a lot of people fall in this area at nighttime when they're tired. People are more likely to buy garbage. That's why the TV shop comes on. What do you call it? No, the TV infomercial things, yeah. And what's the main one called, though? What's the old one?
QVC.
That's it. That's the old one I always remember. QVC. They can't make a profit during the day. They could never run their programs during the day. They can't compete. People aren't in a mentality where they're going to buy the mostly garbage that they're trying to sell them. But at 2 a.m. in the morning, when people are sitting there, kind of awake and kind of taking it in and following along in their boredom, and their wills are diminished, their power to control their actions and their judgment and assessment of things is greatly diminished. So they pick up the phone and they call. And nowadays they go online. Of course, buying garbage on Amazon late at night is just as likely these days. So when I'm looking at young people, I'm realizing that I can teach them, train them, disciple them, inform them, command them, everything. I can do everything. But if I put two young people in the same room that are attracted to one another and there is no one else around, sooner or later, it's just a matter of when. That's the facts. And we can have the most upstanding. When he mentions Roy, when you read the story about Roy, Roy is this kind of very proper, square, high excelling, you know, individual, this character of the perfect kind of boy. If your daughter was starting to, you know, date or whatever, Roy would walk in, you think he's great. You know, she's found herself a keeper. You know, that's how they describe him. But Roy doesn't know himself. And Roy is just like anyone else. And our children are the same. There's no difference. These things don't stop at the limitations of the church, the barriers of the church. So the church in the past, Christians in the past, demanded chaperones. They were honest enough to admit their limitations, and we need to be realistic as well. So with training not being sufficient, there are ways, I believe, that we need to help, and I'll close with this, and we can discuss anything you want after. We need to be aware of the advertising, of the videos, of the content that is accessible when the internet is accessible without barriers. And we need to put barriers, and there are ways that you can do that, and this is what part of my research in recent times has been into thinking about our own children, how to help them. So you can get device-specific filtering. Every iPad comes with certain limitations, certain filters, certain settings that you can set that relate to parental control. It's not the best, but it's there and it's better than nothing. But there are also other apps that you can use, parental control apps, and most of them will require a certain fee per month or per year. I think Kaspersky Safe Kids is maybe it's like one of the cheapest, but a lot of them are you're kind of looking at about $50 a year. There may be limitations on the number of devices, but basically this app allows you to, when it's downloaded and it's on the device, it gives control so that the parent can limit kind of how long they're on, what they can do, what they can see. I haven't looked at all of these apps. I don't know them all inside out. You can do your own research, but this is one way. It's device specific. So if someone walks into your home, if another child is staying overnight, right, it will not impact. If they bring a device with them, it won't be impacted by that. So they come in with their own free iPad or whatever it is, laptop, and it will not in any way be impacted by... You okay? Not in any way be impacted by the that. So that's something to be aware of. So you're having a sleepover, you're having a friend over at the house, that's not going to be impacted by it. Unless you take the device and you download it, that's a whole hassle that their friends probably won't want. The other one is network-specific filtering. So this is a device that impacts the internet at the point in which it comes into the home. So you can get routers that have parental controls. So most of the devices your children are using tend to be Wi-Fi connected. They may be Ethernet connected, but at the point that it's connected to the router, you can have a router, or there are other devices. This is actually what I ended up going with. It's a company called Firewalla, and you can get different. They have different, like four different options depending on the speed of internet that you use and what features you want. But they range from like $100, then the next two is like 180 and 200, and then the top one is like $400. But what that does is, it at the point the internet comes in, it's being kind of filtered. So they give you, you download an app. So I have an app on my phone, and I, with that app, I can set, so internet access, these hours of the day, everything, at least the top two devices they have, every device that connects to your system is put into quarantine that you have to approve before it can even get access. So you see such and such device. So I get kids that run around our home, like neighborhood kids, and then it'll come up, you know, this strange device that's trying to connect to my Wi-Fi. I was like, what's that? And I know it's one of the kids, you know, but they can't get on. Obviously, they don't have the Wi-Fi password anyway. But even that, that's another step of barrier. And it's very helpful. It will show up. You can see the web address. You can block addresses at not just like the www dot, but at the IP level. So, you mean, you can restrict down to anything that's making a connection, uploading, downloading. If you see something suspicious, you can just block it right there, and it won't appear. Again, new apps may connect to the internet in some way, and you can figure out. I'm not going into all details, but it's quite, without going to the level of high-end networking devices that become, you almost need some kind of course. You would need taught and how to use them, because they become very complex, but it's kind of accessible enough to the regular person. And then the third option are accountability tools. So you have certain filters and so on, but also you have someone who is contacted when they detect adult material. And the Christian one that's most commonly used is Covenant Eyes, and this is used broadly by many Christians and believers, and for good reason. So if something happened to come up on the screen, some friend gets notified, and immediately you're under, like, you're aware of that. You know that's going to happen, so that keeps you from doing anything stupid and foolish. Now, none of these are foolproof. I imagine there are workarounds for them all, I would guess. But it's a barrier. It's a fence that hopefully the dog in heat doesn't jump over and find its way over you. You find your best way to prevent. And certainly when our children are young, and they're not looking ways to run out of the fence, they're just innocently trying to browse and look at their little videos and programs and games, and there's stuff coming in, and these things can help limit them coming in and prevent our 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds from seeing things that they shouldn't be seeing. So, any questions?